Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Mati Friedman, author of the new book, Who by Fire? Leonard Cohen in the Sinai. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. My friends, one of the hardest things to preserve in our contemporary world is focus. We're inundated with information on a constant basis coming at us through our many electronic devices, especially our phones, all at a breakneck pace. But most of the information we receive is irrelevant or actually useless. Some of it is even damaging. That's problematic in many ways, of course, but this morning I'm thinking primarily about our American society's inability to stay focused on genuinely important problems long enough to actually fix them, or sometimes even address them. That inability to pay sustained attention to crucial matters allows serious problems to grow unchecked, and minor tsoras to metastasize into major disasters, all while we are diverted by more trivial distractions. For example, in February, Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine constituted a horrifying act of aggressive violence that has had a disastrous impact throughout the world. Putin has slaughtered thousands and thousands of people, including many civilian Ukrainians, destroyed cities and towns, created the worst refugee crisis in Europe since the end of World War II. 6 million Ukrainian refugees have been forced out of their country, and many millions more are internally displaced in Ukraine, and caused a spike in fuel prices that's driving the highest inflation in recent memory. And because of Putin's obsession with trying to recreate the old Soviet Empire, or maybe the Tsarist Empire, it looks like he will also have created a food crisis and potentially massive starvation around the globe, since Ukraine is one of the breadbaskets of the world. This naked attempt by an evil dictator to conquer and destroy a neighboring democracy has been resisted, of course, by Ukrainians, supplied by Europe and the West in general. Russian disinformation and propaganda claim they are denazifying Ukraine when what they are actually doing is acting like Nazis themselves as they try to de-democratize Ukraine and end its independence. Simultaneously, the Russian military is committing many war crimes, ranging from the slaughter of civilians to systematic rapes to targeting whole cities with missiles and artillery. It's awful, and it must be stopped at nearly any cost. All sane Americans see this and subscribe to this. Ah, but this Putin-led invasion has been going on for nearly 3 full months now. So, of course, we Americans can't be expected to continue to still care about this, right? So when the Jewish president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, urgently requests aid, and the U.S. Senate and Congress have to approve it, we see inane partisan idiocy and political posturing delay essential aid to the courageous defenders of Ukraine, who have held out against tremendous odds, are even winning in places, and are fighting for their nation's integrity against pure evil. Our ability to focus on the need to respond with steadfast support for the victims of this brutality, and even to continue to remain engaged in the important work of stopping this evil and alleviating the suffering of the many refugees, well, there are other things that take our American attention. Some are also awful. A horrific racist shooting in Buffalo, New York, fueled by white supremacy, and of course the anti-Semitism of 4chan and hate websites and chat rooms and internet trolls, and by golly, another shooting and another shooting. What is it about us? Other American distractions are less dramatic, but take our attention. Gas prices spiral upward to unheard-of levels. Interest rates are rising. The stock market has fallen dramatically. Everybody's getting ready to travel this summer anyway, whether or not COVID-19 is prevalent, since most of us are well vaccinated and boosted by now. The globe is warming. There is a historic drought here in the Southwest. Elon Musk bought Twitter, or maybe he didn't. And the world keeps turning. There's always another image, story, tweet, text, post, or new streaming show to distract us. Maybe even another model posing in a bathing suit that we can click on. It's getting so that we aren't much good at taking an actual stand on our principles because we're too distracted to remember what they are supposed to be. As a society, we're becoming motivated solely by temporary emotions, anger, mostly, and resentment of something we saw online or read in a feed. And, of course, the eternal American draw of instant gratification. All that steady flow of meaningless information is making us into people of the transitory moments evocation of emotion, instead of the thoughtful people of character we ought to be. Which is what Judaism has always insisted we as adults should be. Judaism is not necessarily concerned with exactly what you believe God is. It surely doesn't think you should be aiming yourself at some future life after death or your conduct here on earth. It certainly does believe that our ability to be truthful, to live up to our ideals, to act on what really matters to us with commitment, dedication, and consistency defines us as human beings. The way we choose to live and the goals we seek for our families and our society testify to our real character. How we seek to do mitzvot, that is, how we fulfill our covenantal commitments, shows the kind of people we really are. And the ever-flowing fountain of information overload that we are all subject to should not distract us from that. Judaism tells us we each have a duty, a moral responsibility, a religious imperative to seek justice in this world. And even amidst all those potential distractions, we must find a way to remain focused on acting to make this world a better, healthier, safer, and holier place, not just for ourselves, but for our children and grandchildren. We have a great guest this morning who's written a terrific short book on a personal favorite of mine, singer, songwriter, poet Leonard Cohen, and about a trip he took to Israel when it was attacked in the Yom Kippur War that changed him and shows us Israel at a remarkable time, a critical one. To play us in this morning, here's Leonard Cohen's most famous song nowadays, Hallelujah, sung by IDF soldiers in Hebrew.
לאלוהים ושאתה שונא תווים ידוע הכל דגום ומסתורי מינור נופל מז'ור ממריא ומלך מבולבל שר הללויה טבלה על גג מולך יפה וירחית עד זעזוע והיא שברה את כתרך והיא גזרה את שערך ושם קשור זימרת
אולי נסעתי שם לשווא, אני לא ממש זוכר עכשיו, האם זה משנה לך, מדוע?
חשוב עם המזמור הוא שבר או שלמות של הללויה.
Those were singers from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah. Our guest this morning, the terrific journalist and author Mati Friedman, has a new book out on that celebrated singer, songwriter, poet Leonard Cohen, exploring a visit he made to Israel in the midst of the Yom Kippur War, during which Cohen visited and performed for IDF troops on battlefields in the Sinai and elsewhere in Israel. It's an amazing story. Find out all about it when we come back on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
To play our guest in this morning, here's an early song from the subject of his book, Leonard Cohen. It's Suzanne, and this is the most beautiful rendition of it by Judy Collins.
Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night forever. And you know that she's half crazy, that's why you want to be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you want to tell her that you have no love to give her, she gets you on her wavelength and touched your perfect body with her mind. And Jesus was...
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a terrific writer and past guest of Too Jewish, Mati Friedman, an award-winning journalist and author of a number of books. His new book is called Who by Fire, Leonard Cohen in the Sinai. It's a great read, and boy, some of it just seems impossible, although true. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So for those of us who are big Leonard Cohen fans, 1973, the Yom Kippur War, he was living on the Greek island of Hydra. Tell us a little bit about how all of this happened.
So in 1973, Leonard Cohen's already an international star, and he has major hits like Suzanne and So Long, Marianne. But in the fall of 1973, he's kind of stuck in his personal life, or so he feels, and stuck professionally. And he's actually declared that he's retiring from music. He's 39 years old. And at that precise moment of crisis in his personal life, a crisis erupts in Israel on Yom Kippur, October 6th, 1973, at 2 p.m. Israel is attacked by the Egyptian army in the south and the Syrian army in the north, and it triggers one of the darkest moments in Israel's history. And in the first week of that war, the army's in disarray and falling back, and there are thousands of casualties ultimately in this three-week war, which is a lot in a very small country. And Leonard Cohen decides to come. He lives on a Greek island, this island of Hydra, and he gets on a ferry to Athens, manages to get on a flight to Tel Aviv, and inserts himself into this Middle Eastern, you know, catastrophe in the fall of 1973.
Now, Leonard Cohen had a tremendous Jewish background from Canada. He hadn't really demonstrated anything particularly Jewish in his connections or in his poetry or in his music at that point. So it's really kind of an incredible act. But as you said, he was in sort of a crisis in his marriage, which ultimately falls apart. Why did he decide that this was the solution to his problems?
I'm not sure he thought it was the solution, but he kind of hoped, I think, that it would be a way out or a way to kind of rejuvenate himself in some way. But part of it, that was only part of his calculations. And I guess we should say we're kind of, you know, trying to read into the mind of someone who's no longer with us. And I'm lucky enough to have access to a very interesting manuscript that he wrote immediately after the war and never published. And the manuscript offers us a window into his brain, but we're still guessing part of the time. But we know that there's a personal crisis in his life and that he's eager to get out of it. And we also know that he has deep Jewish connections and that he feels deeply tied to the fate of the Jewish people and to Israel. And we know this because his poetry in the 1960s is full of references to Jews in Israel, and his Jewish past is woven like a thread in his work, even if it's sometimes subsumed below the surface. But Leonard Cohen grew up steeped in Jewish tradition and Jewish knowledge. He grows up in a very important synagogue in Montreal called Shaar HaShamayim, the Gate of Heaven. And his family is one of the most important families in the synagogue. His grandfather had been the president of the synagogue, and so had his great-grandfather. And another grandfather on a different side was an important rabbi, a scholar of Hebrew grammar. So Leonard Cohen grows up just kind of surrounded by Judaism, and it's always part of his life. And the Yom Kippur crisis kind of brings out this desire to, you know, be part of what's going on, and maybe a refusal to stand by at a moment of grave crisis for the Jewish people. So I think that's a big part of his decision to go.
We will talk much more with Mati Friedman about his fascinating book, Who by Fire, Leonard Cohen at the Sinai. We will return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Shavuot is coming up a week from Saturday night, 7:30 p.m., our all-night, well, kind of all-night, it's Tucson after all, study session, the Tikkun Leil Shavuot, on the subject, What is Holiness?, begins at 7:30 p.m., and there'll be a cheesecake bake-off and all kinds of delicious treats to eat and drink. That's coming up June 4th, 7:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha. Or, of course, join us every Friday night in person or on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services with full music are in person and virtual. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live in person and on Zoom. You can access all of that by emailing me, Rabbi, at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our fabulous religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live and some attending on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services on Facebook and in person, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Please post a rating and a good review of Too Jewish whenever you listen to our podcast. Those comments help us. Our guest this morning, Mati Friedman, has written a terrific little book about Leonard Cohen coming to Israel during the Yom Kippur War, which tells us a lot about Israel, what it was like then, and at that critical moment. Here's a lovely little song of Leonard Cohen's that was very popular back then. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye.
I love you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your hair upon pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us. I know that we are not new in city and in forest. They smiled like me and you, but now it's come to distances and both of us must try. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. I'm not looking for another as I wander in my time. Walk me to the corner, our steps will always rhyme. You know my love goes with you as your love stays with me. It's just the way it changes like the shoreline and the sea. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your head on the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us. I know that we are not new in city and in forest. They smiled like me and you, but let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye.
That was Leonard Cohen's Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. We aren't saying goodbye. We'll hear much more about him and lots of other things in a moment here on Too Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The Jewish community of Egypt brings up memories of Passover, and we left there a long time ago, and that's all most Jews, I think, know, but it is a tremendous history, and as people who've been to Egypt a number of times and experienced some of the remarkable aspects of the Jewish community, maybe we can talk about one of the most extraordinary and unusual Jewish communities of all time that goes back, oh, a cool 2,600-2,700 years ago, the Jewish community of Elephantine Island.
Right. That's part of the rich history of the Jewish presence in Egypt, which, you know, similar to what I often say about Jewish communities in any given European country, it's a series of different Jewish communities, not necessarily with overlap, not necessarily with continuity. The Elephantine Island is especially interesting because the Jews left Egypt in the story that we recount every Passover somewhere in the 13th century before the Common Era. And something like 500 years later, they voluntarily returned to this island in the southern Nile near what is today the border between Egypt and Sudan, but in ancient times was the border between the kingdom of Egypt and the kingdom of the Nubians. And there was some political instability in Israel. There were wars between the two kingdoms. And
imagine that political instability in biblical Israel. How could that be?
And even this is long before, like at least 100 years, maybe 150 years before the destruction of the First Temple, a large number of Jews emigrated. They returned to Egypt in spite of their historical memory. And they became largely mercenaries working as soldiers for pay for the Egyptian government to guard the border with Nubia. And they engaged in some commerce and some piracy and some other things. And it's not entirely clear. Half of them were Shomronim. I think the English word for that is Samaritans.
Yeah, or maybe Sumerians. We're not really sure whether they were really Samaritans or if they were Northern Kingdom Israelites who had gone south. It's hard
to say. Whose rites were a little bit different from other Jews.
Definitely got some different rituals.
But they built a temple, which for a period of time was the only Jewish temple in the world because the first temple in Israel was destroyed in 586 before the Common Era.
By the Babylonians, all gone.
Right. And there was a functioning temple at which this Jewish community made animal sacrifices. And eventually, their practices became more and more syncretistic, and they involved elements that some rabbis considered avodah zarah, like idolatry.
Right.
And eventually, at some point in the 4th or 5th century before the Common Era, this community just disappeared. I mean, there were lots of records and documentary evidence, papyri.
Papyri, right, the famous Elephantine Island papyri. Right. That's something written on papyrus that saved in that incredibly dry climate forever, nearly.
So, I mean, those documents cover a good 3 or 4 centuries, and then they're gone. And the next major appearance of a Jewish community in Egypt is 600 miles to the north in Alexandria, which we can talk about in more detail next time.
Thanks, Tom. Fascinating story of the Elephantine Island Jewish community. There have been stories and books written about it, and some of us think it's well known, but that's not actually true.
Right.
It should be. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Shmuel is leading a Torah study at his shul when all of a sudden an angel appears. The angel says to the rabbi, "Rabbi Shmuel, you're an example to all human beings. You are totally unselfish. Your behavior is faultless. Your study of Judaism extensive. And your giving of tzedakah, charity, is exemplary. In return for being such a mensch, I'm going to offer you a reward. You can have either infinite wealth, infinite health, or infinite wisdom. What will it be, Rabbi Shmuel? Wealth, health, or wisdom? Whatever you choose, your wish will be immediately granted." Without any hesitation, Rabbi Shmuel replies, "I would love to have infinite wisdom." "Mazel tov, Rabbi Shmuel," says the angel. "It's done. Enjoy." The angel disappears as quickly as it appeared. There's a stunned silence in the Torah study group. No one believes what's just happened. Then one of the group breaks the silence. "Rabbi Shmuel," he asks, "why don't you test out your newfound wisdom right away? Say something incredibly wise to us, Rabbi." And Rabbi Shmuel replies, "I should have taken the money." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and take the money. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we complete reading the book of Leviticus with a portion of the Torah known as Bechukotai. At the completion of a book focused on holiness and its rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude our exploration with a statement of covenant. God says, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land I give you." It's a promise based on action. If we live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions will bring blessings. We have the capacity to create a world with meaning and goodness. But holiness is an unusual idea. In Judaism, holiness is usually something we create rather than something given to us from above or outside. An example may demonstrate that. A sheepskin is not a holy object, right? Where I'm from originally, in Southern California, they cover car seats, especially if you have a convertible. Nothing holy about that. So what happens if you take that sheepskin, remove the hair, cure it into a parchment? Is it holy now? No, just a piece of parchment. But if you take that parchment, give it to a sofer, a scribe, he writes on it or she writes on it a section of the Torah, and if that piece of parchment is sewn together with other text like that, and the whole thing is rolled around Atzei Chaim, wooden poles, and if it's dedicated and carried around a synagogue and chanted from publicly, blessings are said over it, it's used for bar and bat mitzvahs, touched, kissed with the fringes of a tallis, well, now that piece of parchment has become much more than it was. It has become holy, a Torah, through our own actions. We have taken a common object, a sheepskin we could have used for any number of things, and created out of it an object, a Torah that is sacred. The abiding lesson of Leviticus is that we have the capacity to make our own lives holy in a similar way. We can lead lives that are ordinary and prosaic, or we can choose to live truly holy lives. That choice is, in fact, an ethical one. We make that choice every day, perhaps every hour, when we decide how we are going to act. When we give freely of ourselves, as Leviticus asks, we increase holiness in the world. Perhaps even more importantly, we give our own lives beauty, meaning, and sanctity. Real holiness. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Mati Friedman, the outstanding Israeli journalist and writer, tells us what really motivated Leonard Cohen to head to the Sinai in the midst of the Yom Kippur War and how it changed him forever. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, 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 aseinu. Palestinian man tried stabbing a soldier in the West Bank and was shot, the Israeli army reported last week. The army said the man ran towards soldiers posted outside the Shomron Regional Brigade military base near Nablus. He was armed with a knife, waving his hand in the air. It can be seen in a security video that's online. I watched it. No soldiers were harmed. The wounded suspect was evacuated to Beilinson Hospital in Petah Tikva in central Israel. After the stabbing attempt, Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the West Bank with Israeli military chief Aviv Kochavi, where he declared Israel will hit every terrorist wherever they are using any means necessary. Also last week, IDF security forces arrested 18 Palestinians suspected of involvement in terrorist activities throughout the West Bank. Tensions have been high amid a spate of deadly Palestinian terror attacks on Israelis on both sides of the Green Line over the past 2 months, as well as clashes between Palestinians and Israeli security forces in Jerusalem and the West Bank. A string of Palestinian attacks on Israelis over the past 2 months has left 19 Israelis dead, and at least 27 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in operations to locate and apprehend suspects in the Palestinian terrorist attacks. Stefania, mama, mama, Stefania, rozkwitaje pole, a wona sywije. Zaspiwaj meni, mamo, kolyskowu, choć już się poczuty twoje wite słowo. Wona mene kolesala, dala mene rytę, mina panie celu polie, nie zabrata mene podala, wona na mene znala, może bilsie i bit sola, mona lo. This year's Eurovision Song Contest did not go Israel's way, but even though Israel didn't make it to the final for the first time in 6 years, it did have representation in Turin, Italy last week. That's because Ukraine, which won the competition with Kalush Orchestra's Stefania rap song, filmed its introductory video in Israel. The intro, known in Eurovision jargon as the postcard, features contestants who typically are filmed in a place of their choosing in the country that hosts that year's contest, normally the country that won the previous year. Obviously, the war has complicated traveling out of Ukraine, where civilian flights stopped ever since Russia invaded February 24th. Filming in Ukraine has become, well, dangerous. So Ukraine's public broadcaster arranged for the Kalush Orchestra to travel to Israel last month and record their video there, which was shown in the grand final before the contestants' live performances. The Ukrainian band's recording in Israel took place at the headquarters of the Jewish Agency in Jerusalem, in the very room where Chaim Weizmann was sworn in as Israel's first president. The final video does not feature Israel. It shows the band members who were filmed against a green screen against drone footage from several monuments in Italy. Anyway, while they were there, the Ukrainian band, which is really quite wild and good, also performed live for Jewish refugees from Ukraine. About 50 of the refugees enjoyed an unplugged rendition of Stefania, their winner from last year. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Mati Friedman, an award-winning journalist and author of a number of books. Born in Toronto, in Canada, like his subject of his book, Leonard Cohen and the Sinai, has been in a number of prominent publications and has written some terrific books, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel, Pumpkin Flowers, really a wonderful book, and the Aleppo Codex. Leonard Cohen goes to the Sinai. Well, he goes to Israel, right, to help by entertaining the troops. There was a whole kind of system in the IDF in which prominent Israeli performers and others would come and sing for the troops when they had a break. But the Yom Kippur War was so existential, things had kind of broken down. You have some stories in the book about Israeli singers who were sent to, you know, outfits in the Golan who had lost like most of their people and, you know, really kind of right near the front lines, traumatic stuff. This was a crazy moment in Israel's history, kind of the last existential war, you could make a case. What happened when he got there?
One of the interesting things that I learned when researching this story was that Cohen almost certainly did not intend to play for troops when he came, and he came without a guitar, and he came after having announced that he was retiring from the music business.
Yeah.
So he tells people that he meets at the beginning of his visit that what he wants to do is volunteer on a kibbutz and, you know, help replace the men who'd been called up to the front. And that was something that was commonly done by North American volunteers in the Six-Day War, which happened 6 years earlier. And he's in a cafe in Tel Aviv after his arrival. And in this cafe, he's recognized by a few Israeli musicians. And these musicians are on their way to play for troops because, as you mentioned, in an Israeli war, Israeli performers go to the front and play for troops. And I guess it's worth mentioning that, you know, for Israelis, the wars are very close. You don't have to get on an airplane and fly to Iraq or fly to Vietnam. You get into your car and you drive for an hour or two and you're at the front.
You're at the front lines.
Right. So it's all very immediate. And musicians can really get right up to the front lines. And that's where they're headed. And they kind of convince Leonard Cohen to drop his kibbutz plan. And they find him a guitar. And they get into a car, which was a Ford Falcon. And they set off on what ended up being quite an incredible moment in rock history and in Jewish history.
Cohen shows up and he's, tell us about his journey. You know, tell us a little bit about the story, because you interviewed a number of people who heard him. And of course, you had this manuscript of his. Tell us sort of what happened.
The journey really begins when he meets these performers in a cafe, and he ends up touring with a kind of pickup band of Israeli musicians who happen to be among the most prominent performers in Israel. Names that wouldn't be familiar, I think, to an American audience for the most part,
right,
but are very familiar to Israelis even today. And they initially play at an Air Force base for air crews that are being really shredded by anti-aircraft missiles in the first week of the war. It's the worst week in the history of the Israeli Air Force, and losses are so high that they're being hidden from the public. So this is the audience that Cohen's playing for. These are people who are, you know, one of the darkest moments of their lives, people who know that, you know, this could be the last thing they hear. So they know that, and he knows that. And it creates these very charged concerts that are a matter of life and death. And, you know, no one's buying tickets, no one's buying records, no money is changing hands at all. It's kind of a pure artistic transmission. So it starts at this Air Force base, and then they fly Cohen down to the desert, to Sinai, where the Israeli army is fighting the Egyptian army. And he begins a tour of the front that's completely kind of disorganized. It's nothing like a Bob Hope, you know, USO type tour.
Yeah.
These aren't, you know, bases in the rear where it's safe. He's moving around the front in a Jeep. He's very close to the front lines. At one point, he crosses the Suez Canal a day or two behind the Israeli army, which is quite remarkable. The army counterattacks across the Suez Canal, which is the border between the Egyptian army and the Israelis. And this is the counterattack that changes the course of the war. And Cohen is there. I mean, there was clearly no one in charge of the tour who could say, you know, maybe it's not such a good idea for an international star like Leonard Cohen to be on territory that is only tenuously held by the Israeli army.
Right.
And indeed, we know that he was in danger several times. And it's quite an exciting experience, I think, for Cohen. And I think also, you know, quite an upsetting experience. If you're a sensitive person who's in a war, you're bound to be rattled by it. And I think Cohen was.
You know, Cohen was a poet. He thought of himself as a poet before he became a music star, and then, of course, a big folk rock star. He's, you know, right there on the front lines when all this is happening. he sees this initially in some of the writings, is he almost, it was like a kind of a suicide mission in some ways. I mean, he was so upset and depressed when he went to Israel. It revived him, though, this experience.
It seems to have revived him in some kind of mysterious way. And when he sets off to Israel, as he tells us in this manuscript, which I quote from in the book, I got rare permission from the Cohen estate to use this kind of unpublished material, which is, again, very raw and kind of unfiltered, but very, very honest and very, very interesting, kind of remarkable, actually.
Yeah.
And he tells us that he has this hope that in Israel he'll be able to sing again, that something will happen that will, you know, change the course of his life and career. And Cohen is such a, you know, kind of a cagey character. He never says in an interview afterward that the Yom Kippur War changed the course of his life. And he never spoke about his process in that way. And he never makes it easy for interviewers or for journalists like me who are trying to figure out what he was thinking. So all we can do is note that right before the war, he said he was retiring, that he told an interviewer that he just wanted to shut up. And immediately after the war, he releases one of the best albums of his career, which is called New Skin for the Old Ceremony. And you can imagine what the old ceremony is that he's referring to. And he, has put out this album that includes not only Chelsea Hotel, which is one of his most famous songs, but also songs like Who by Fire, which is influenced, of course,
fantastic,
by the Yom Kippur liturgy and clearly influenced by his experience in the war.
Yeah.
And also the song Lover, 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 which is another big Cohen hit that was actually written in the war.
You know, you mentioned Who by Fire, which is, of course, the Natana Tokev kind of reinterpreted in this contemporary way. I mean, he was right there. You mentioned other performers who, you know, came up and sat on a bulldozer and sang to people, and there were still dead Israeli bodies around. Did Cohen have anything quite that traumatic happen to him?
When you speak to the musicians who toured with Cohen, as I did, they described things that were not too far from that. I mean, one of them described being in the desert, just driving along miles and miles of desert road in a van and stopping alongside the road and not understanding why there were all these flies around. And then noticing that the place where they'd chosen to take a break and sit in the shade was surrounded by bodies in the sand that were half buried in the sand. So it's pretty clear that that Cohen was, again, not in the rear. He was right at the front, and he saw things that shook him, and he talks about it in his manuscript a bit. He doesn't give us a lot of journalistic information, which is, you know, frustrating for a journalist who's trying to put together the history. But of course, Cohen is not a journalist, and he doesn't claim to be a historian. He's, you know, trying to address the human condition, and he's a, you know, a poet of the universal soul. But he gives us many descriptions of the war that make it clear that this was quite, I think, an emotional experience for him, in some ways in a positive way, and in other ways, I think, in a way that was quite upsetting and kind of that left a lasting impression that wasn't all good.
There's a magnificent moment at the end of Cohen's career where he goes back to Israel. I think it might have been his last trip to Israel. And you could watch the concert. Obviously, his voice is now dropped to, I don't know, sub-bass. I'm not sure what to call it, but still, it's very effective. He never thought he was a good singer, by the way. And he stands there and he does the Birkat Kohanim. It's kind of a completion, but it feels almost like it's, he's come full circle. You talk about it a little bit in your book. Can you explore that a little with us?
Sure. One of the things that I was surprised to discover in looking at Cohen's own account of the war was how preoccupied he was with the fact that he's a Cohen. I mean, his name's Leonard Cohen, so we understand that he's from a family of Kohanim, of priests, of course, descendants of the temple priests from...
Theoretically descendants of Aaron, or maybe Tzadok, and, you know, goes all the way back, right?
Right, exactly. And today the Kohanim don't have to sacrifice goats and stuff like that, but they do have an important job, which is to recite this blessing called Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing. And what the blessing is, it's just 15 words. It's very, very brief. It calls down divine protection on the congregation. And it starts, Yivarechecha Hashem Vishmerecha, may God bless and protect you. And it's kind of an invocation of divine protection. And Cohen was very much aware that he was a Cohen. And he once said that when he was a kid, they told him he was a Cohen, and he didn't think this was irrelevant information. This was some important detail about his personality or about his role, and he's conscious of having a job to play in the life of the community and not playing it, because of course he's left the synagogue and he's left his home in Montreal and he's kind of out in the great world living in Greenwich Village and then living on this Greek island, and it clearly bothered him. He knew it. He knew there was something he was supposed to be doing that he wasn't doing, and it recurs in this manuscript about the war. And then there's this great moment that you mentioned where he comes back here in 2009 for his last concert in Israel. And this is really his last communication with the Israeli audience. And this is Cohen in his 70s after he's been kind of resurrected as an elderly man who is filling stadiums, you know, on this great resurrection tour around that time. And he ends the tour in Tel Aviv with this, you know, rendition of the priestly blessing, which completely surprised the 50,000 people who were there, and is remembered as a religious moment by Israelis. And I remember hearing about it immediately afterward because people who were there were so moved, and it was moving even though most people in the stadium didn't know his story in the war and didn't know how central this identity as a Cohen was to him. But I think it was, as you said, it was kind of the closing of a circle. It was the final memory that Israelis have of Leonard Cohen, who Israelis really consider to be almost an Israeli artist. I mean, Israelis love many foreign artists, but I don't think there's a foreign artist that they love as much as they love Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Again, bringing us back to that moment, the Yom Kippur War, when it, you know, we're not sure Israel's going to survive. I don't think there's been a moment like it since then, thank God. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Mati, when is the where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Best place to go would be my website, which is just my name, matifriedman.com.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Michael Benson, author of the stirring new nonfiction book, Gangsters vs. Nazis, documenting a remarkable chapter in American Jewish history in the lead-up to World War II. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, all live in person. The Torah study is on Zoom, but all the services are on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Leonard Cohen, and it's his Who by Fire, inspired by that experience during the Yom Kippur War and by the text from the Machzor for the Jewish High Holy Days from the Unetana Tokef. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.